Asian men in the United States must often battle stereotypes, being ineffective, weak, even sexless. We will talk with an author this hour about his experiences growing up in the U.S. as an immigrant from the Philippines and how he reconciled these messages with a less stereotyped vision of masculinity and himself. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We will talk with the author of Big Little Man, In Search of My Asian Self. And we will welcome any questions you might have for him, any experiences you may have had as an Asian man, or for that matter, Asian woman. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Let me welcome our guest, very happy to have with us, Alex Tizon, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author of Big Little Man, In Search of My Asian Self. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. So what motivated you to write your memoir?
It was the one book I had to write before I died.
Yeah, why?
Well, it was the thing that was calling out to me. So I'm 54, and at age 50, I decided I needed to write a book, and a book was trying to come out of me. Wasn't sure what form it would take, and this was really the most important one. It was the most important story for me to tell.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a short story of why I wrote the book.
And the title refers to you. You are the big little man.
Yes, directly it refers to me, but indirectly it does refer to Asian Americans as a whole, and also Asia as an entity that is at the moment little, but growing very fast and soon to become possibly the biggest man on the planet.
Well, we'll talk a little bit more about that too, but let's talk first about your family's background. Talk some about the transition from living in the Philippines for your parents and your siblings.
Sure. We grew up poor in the Philippines, as a lot of Filipinos do, and we immigrated to this country with seven cardboard boxes, all of our belongings in cardboard boxes. Arrived in the mid-60s, right in the midst of civil rights demonstrations and demonstrations about the Vietnam War. And there was a lot of talk about race during the 60s when we arrived. And race turned out to be the lens through which my family began to view our own experience and interpret our own experience. We started seeing ourselves as Orientals, which was the name of the category at the time. We were Orientals, and so we with that identity, we tried our best to become what we thought was the ideal, which was to become an American. And in becoming an American, we had to let go of those aspects of ourselves that were Oriental. And that was a real...
Yeah.
It was a difficult, painful process.
What did you have to let go of?
The immediate thing was that we had to let go of our language. And once you let go of language, you let go of the entire world that language represents, and you start over, basically, which was difficult for my parents. My parents came here in midlife, and so they let go of the only language that they knew well. And they came to this country, and they were mumblers for the rest of their lives. There were pupils learning English, and I had to learn English as well, but I was a young boy, and I had time to learn it.
Mm-hmm.
So we let go of language, we let go of ways of behaving, traditions, cultures. It was our own cultural practices. annihilation. We tried to erase, essentially, erase who we were in order to fit in, to become more American.
Yeah. And did America demand this of you?
No, not directly. Not directly. It came in a benevolent pressure. I'll give you an example. One of our biggest teachers was the television.
Yeah.
The television and movies as well. So we spent lots and lots of time in front of the television, trying to learn how Americans lived and behaved and looked. And the television in our eyes painted pictures of what a strong American was, what an irrelevant person was, what was good, what was bad, what was ugly, what was beautiful. And in absorbing these ideas, we came to understand that Asian people, or Orientals as we were called, we didn't rank very high in that hierarchy of manhood in particular. We were usually houseboys, servants, background characters, victims, or evil, sneaky little perpetrators. Those were the roles that we saw on television for people who looked like us. And that wasn't anything planned by American society. It did reflect, though, the general worldview that Americans held of Oriental people.
And you wrote about these media representations of Asian men as being weak or ineffectual. Did the real people you encountered seem to believe those stereotypes?
The real Americans?
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, that was an accepted notion. It still is in some ways a pretty prevalent notion among Americans. The worst part, though, was that we believed it. We internalized those messages. We saw ourselves as secondary, as lesser, or as weak. Life was a constant attempt to overcome those things.
Yeah, you write. You also wrote about a sense of invisibility, being lumped in with all the other short, skinny, black-haired people of the world. Talk a little bit more about that.
Oh yeah, well yeah, that was it. Was the experience of checking that box on every form that you have to fill out. You know what race you are, and we had to check. At the time, we were checking the box that was Oriental. And the act of checking that box over months and years, and all the other short, brown-skinned, black-haired people of the world checking the same box, kind of lumped us together into one category. So immigrants from the Philippines and Japan and China and Indonesia and Malaysia and Taiwan, Korea. We were all lumped in together as just one entity, and we were Orientals. That is a form of invisibility. It's not being seen as an individual, but seen as this kind of faceless collective.
Yeah, and didn't you get upset when you had I believe it was an American. Criticize you or spew some hate at you because he thought you were Chinese?
Oh, yes. Yeah. That's I had an encounter in the Bronx. We lived in the Bronx, New York for 3 years. There was just, it was an odd experience because this was, he was a little kid. A little kid who was obviously a psychopath. There are small psychopaths in, in New York City. But he basically came at me in a very aggressive way with a, turned out to be a toy gun. Just stepped in front of my face, pointed the barrel of the gun 2 inches from my face, and said, can I swear on this show? But he basically said...
No. I mean, you can use the S word. I mean, say the S word instead or whatever.
he said, you want to die, you Chinese F? Mm. And he said it a few times, and he said it, you could hear the menace in his voice and in his eyes. He had these little ball-bearing eyes, and he came out of nowhere. Ultimately, nothing happened. Ultimately, I pushed the barrel of the gun aside and just said, I'm not Chinese, and walked away, and he walked away. It was a nothing incident that has stayed with me for 40 years.
Yeah, I can imagine. So what messages did you take away from all of these representations?
The messages were, in a nutshell, that I come from a lesser stock of man, that I am myself a lesser man, that I didn't have the necessary characteristics to become a leading man in any of the arenas that mattered. And those arenas I'm talking about are arenas like love and courtship or professional work or in dramas involving conflict. Almost any important arena of life, I felt like I would have to play a background role, which was the role that I saw. I saw depicted in not just on television and movies, but in history books as well.
Yeah. So, do you think the experience of an Asian American or an Asian growing up in America today is a lot different than it was for you?
Yes. It's a lot different with much of it the same. See if I can answer that. America has definitely changed. The world is changing and the economic balance of power in the world is shifting east toward Asia. There have been many more successful Asian American men and women who've risen to the tops of their fields, and today Asian American young men and women actually have models that they can look at and they can see that there are. That it's possible for someone like them to reach the top, to not play a background role, to actually be at the forefront of events. And that makes a huge difference, just to be able to see people who look like you, who come from your culture, do these things, because it tells you that if they can do it, you can too. On the other hand, yes, there those same stereotypes that I dealt with in the 60s and 70s and 80s, they linger. And you can tell they linger if you get online and get on any Asian American website that explores Asian American life. That theme, particularly among men, the theme of being second class or lesser or the big word, undesirable or sexless. Asian men still grapple with that, particularly young Asian men who are trying to forge their own identity.
We are talking about Asian American stereotypes and masculinity. And we are welcoming your thoughts and questions as we talk with Alex Tizon, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author of Big Little Man, In Search of My Asian Self. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. What is your perception of Asian Americans? Second class, weak, ineffective, sexless? We are talking with a guest author about his experiences growing up in the U.S. as an immigrant from the Philippines and how he reconciled these messages with a different vision of masculinity and himself. And we are welcoming your questions, your experiences, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Well, you know, we have callers, so let me see what Janice in Clover would like to ask. Hello, Janice, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to add, I didn't listen to the entire show, but I tuned in about the time that the comment about the TV images, how they influenced him. And I just never thought of Asians as being lesser because, and I wanted to add that I'm 66 years old, so you have, you know, where I come from. I always thought of them as doctors and dentists. My dentist was an Asian. So that was just a surprise to me, and I guess that's really all I have to say.
So what's your response to that, Alex?
Yes, I've actually, my mother eventually became a doctor, and later in my life, I was exposed to these communities of professional people and doctors, and that's really a development within the last 20 years. 20 to 25 years or so. But when we first arrived, my family arrived in 1964, there were only 800,000 Asians spread across the whole country, and very few of them at the time were doctors. And so I didn't grow up with the idea of, I didn't see a lot of Asians working in those kind of high status, high power, how he positions. How if you look at the landscape today, oh my gosh, there are entire medical schools and law schools that are dominated by Asian students, which gives you a glimpse of what the future is going to be. More Asian Americans earn bachelor's and master's and doctorates in the United States, even though Asians, Asian Americans, comprise only 5% of the population. So there is some truth to that stereotype of Asians as bookish, as studious. There's truth to that, and it comes from the Confucian ethic that, you know, that stems from China that affected all of Asia, and so that's why you saw a lot of doctors, caller, and they're definitely communities there, and that is changing. That's part of the change that I was talking about earlier, and why the perception of Asians and Asian Americans is undergoing a rapid change. I believe that our perceptions of Asians will be radically different in 20, 30, 40 years.
You write about the bamboo ceiling. Is that something you faced or that Asian men still face today?
Yes, to an extent. It's no doubt that there is a ceiling. The problem with those ceilings feelings is that you don't really know when you've hit it. You might be declined for a raise or a new job, a new position or a promotion. And there'll be an official reason for you not receiving that promotion. And so we don't know whether that official reason reflects a kind of unspoken bamboo ceiling. But I think people who have studied the phenomenon do see that for example, in certain sectors, you'll have a lot of Asian American worker bees. But once you get to management level, you'll see very few Asian Americans on the management level. There's a very revealing paper that came out a few years ago called Paper Tigers by a writer named Wesley Yang, who talks a lot about the bamboo ceiling, and he gives specific examples. For example, in computer programming, where a huge percentage of the workers are Asian American, but only a tiny fraction actually break through to middle and upper management. Why is that? I mean, the only thing, one of the theories is that a bamboo ceiling exists.
Yeah, and I apologize, you didn't write that. It was an article that I wanted to ask you about. Don in West Dallas is with us. Hello, Don.
Hi, I just wanted to say, I do agree that there are some of those stereotypes out there, but in my experience, and I have many Asian friends, and I went to a school with a large Asian population, Asian men and women especially are far outrepresented in universities more than any other minority. I think they are excelling and doing quite good work, and I just don't see those stereotypes as much as maybe somebody who studied it, like your guest, but I don't see that in my, culture sphere.
Right, and Don, I'm sorry. You're saying today, rather than our guest is kind of talking about growing up in the 70s in particular.
Right. I think that has changed. I think even since the mid-90s, those opinions have changed, and it's become fully accepted as far as, education and success in business. And I guess some of the statistics might prove me wrong when he talks about the managerial positions where Asians hold. But I just don't see that. I think they're thriving and doing very well and completely acclimated, especially those people of Asian descent that have been here for one or two generations. So.
I don't mean to press you down, but didn't you also want to talk about the perception of Asian men as being sexless and that you don't
perceive that? I don't perceive that either. Again, just knowing and having, many friends, and I'm, again, not totally immersed in the culture, but, many different Asian people from Hmong to Chinese to Japanese, people that I'm involved with business, seem to do very, very well socially with women. And perhaps, I don't know if they're talking about women that are outside of their own, background or, maybe outside of the Asian culture, but they seem to do quite well and be, doing, they seem to dedicate a lot of their time to business and things like that and their education, so that maybe doesn't give them the time to socialize as much as they would like to, but I just don't see that. And just wondering if you think things have changed, from the 70s to 2014.
Yes, they have definitely changed and are rapidly changing. And what you say about success in dating and mating and courtship, that is true among the homegrown Asian Americans, the ones who, like you said, grew up here, second, third generations, they do much better than immigrant Asians. But we have to remember that two-thirds of Asians living in born, like me. I was foreign born. And we, the foreign born ones, do tend to have a harder time in the dating and mating and courtship scene. And that is, that reality is reflected in all kinds of discussion groups and chat rooms and websites where people, Asians, lament how hard it is for them, in particular for the men, for them to, you know, to get a date on Saturday night. And there have been studies by Columbia University and University of Santa Barbara, actually numerous studies on desirability, desirability among races. And consistently, Asian men, not Asian women, but Asian men, are consistently rated the least desirable of men, even by Asian women in America, which, of course, is a blow to the solar plexus to me.
And talk about why you think that is.
I think that there are a plethora of reasons. The Asian people that have come to the United States, many of them, come from countries that have been recently conquered, colonized, and people who come from conquered and colonized cultures, like myself. I came from the Philippines, which was a Spanish colony and an American colony for 400 years. You know, we come out of there, there's this thing that they call a colonial mentality, which is a way of seeing the world in which your master, your conqueror, is the ideal, and the ideal that you shoot for. And it's a little bit of what we were talking about earlier. In order to become the ideal, you have to erase much of yourself. And I think that many, many Asian Americans here in the United States, particularly the foreign-born ones, are in the process of doing that. Now, it's different for Asian women. In this area, it's different because Asian women are culturally accepted as being desirable. They're on the other end of the spectrum. Asian men are on the other end of the spectrum, and they're considered the least desirable.
And we will get into Asian women. We have a caller on that as well. But I wanted to just talk a little bit more. I mean, the title of the book, Big Little Man, is about the image of Asian men as being physically small. What does height, strength, size have to do with feeling masculine?
Desirable, yes. It's a big part. Across cultures, the male ideal has to do with not just necessarily physical size, but power. Women in all cultures seem drawn to expressions or potentials of power. So when they see a man that has position or status, they're seen as being more desirable as a mate. Now, physical size plays into it because physical size comes to symbolize power. So the taller man, the bigger man, is automatically seen as being a more powerful man. So across cultures, bigger, taller men are looked up to more than shorter men. And so there is the truth that most of the immigrants from Asia in the past 150 to 200 years have come from South China or Southeast Asia. And those people, I'm one of them, we tend to be shorter than the average American height. But we're not representative of Asia as a whole, because if you travel to Central and Northern and Eastern Asia, those people are comparable in size to Europeans, but they're not the ones who immigrated. So the perception of Asians as small has some truth to it, but it's only a partial truth. The truth is that if you take Asians as a whole, they're really not small people. There are segments of the population that are small, but overall, if you take Asia as a huge, I forget, it has 4 billion people on it, covers a huge swath of geography, and there are all sorts of ethnicities and body types and languages and that live in these, or that exist in these swaths of geography that make up Asia. I'm sort of roaming off into.
No, you're answering the question. Let me take a caller, Amy in Waukesha, who I wanted to have join us. Hi, Amy.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to give a quick comment. I find the conversation really interesting. As an Asian woman living in the United States, I'm Korean American, and I actually was adopted as a baby from South Korea, but. You know, just from my earliest memories, it's hard to go anywhere, whether it's school, whether it's a social environment, without being commented upon just for being Asian, whether it's like, oh, you know, hey, you look just like this Asian person I know, or like this person on TV I saw, you look just like them. Or people, the other part of it is, strangers coming up to me and asking, like, oh, where are you from? Are you Chinese? Are you Japanese? And just going on and on. Like, the first thing they want to know before my name, before anything, is like, oh, where are you from? What are you? And it's a huge part of just kind of my life, just going day to day and, you know, expecting comments and questions like that from well-meaning people. It's just, you know, it's just a part of I guess my identity. But you know, talk about being faceless, you know, being compared to complete strangers, or being you know, your identity being assumed by other people. So
Alex, you want to respond to that?
No, I can relate to everything you just said. I grew up with that myself. You know, honestly, I didn't mind that part of it. I didn't mind people coming up and asking me where I was from. I think it's just a natural curiosity that people have, and maybe there's a little bit of insensitivity involved, because the people who come up and ask you where you're from don't consider the fact that maybe you've been asked that question 100 times this month. But you're right. What you said was that, yeah, most of the folks who do that are well-meaning people who are curious, maybe want to get to know you or talk to you. May I ask the caller a question?
Yes.
Did you ever receive unwanted male attention? In other words, did you have men or boys be interested in you because of...
I mean... Yeah, the thing I would mention is as far as the where are you from question is most often from white men. I mean, I could be in a bar situation, or I could be getting my oil changed and get that question. And to me, you know, I'm willing to answer that question, and most times I don't take offense to it. However, you know, and that's the first thing coming out of someone's mouth to me, you know, and I'm just trying to go about my day, and, you know, especially from men I don't even know.
Yeah.
That's something that, you know, bothers me from time to time.
So. Amy, I'm prying, but I think what we're trying to get at is were white men very romantically attracted to you, and did you receive a lot of unwanted attention because you're Asian?
One thing that I can say that I've heard multiple times is, I'm really attracted to Asian women. And I've even heard, I've heard Asian women are more subservient or submissive. And I just, it astounds me that somebody would say that out loud to somebody, especially to somebody they don't know. That kind of comment is definitely unwanted.
Yeah, and that's what we're talking about, Alex?
Yes, it is. It's the, Asian women are, it's culturally accepted that Asian women are desirable in general, just more desirable than maybe other women, and particularly more desirable than Asian men. And because it's accepted culturally, there are all kinds of men who'll be open about saying, yeah, I love Asian women. You hear that on Seinfeld and Friends and all sorts of mainstream television shows because it's a mainstream belief. And it, I write about it in the book. I spent two chapters on Asian women, and I know that particular stereotype really adds a whole complex and difficult dimension to life in America for Asian women. I have six sisters. They're all, in my eyes, they're all smart and beautiful and attractive people. But they get quite a bit of attention just for being Asian. Of course, most of the attention is unwanted.
Yeah, let me jump in because we're past our break time. And welcome more listeners to our conversation about stereotypes and Asian Americans or masculinity and Asian American stereotypes. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. What do you think of what our guest is saying? Are Asian women considered desirable, but Asian men are not, particularly foreign-born Asian Americans? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking with the author of Big Little Man, In Search of My Asian Self, Alex Tizon, and we are welcoming your thoughts and questions for him about stereotypes and Asian Americans. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. And let's go to another caller. Lynn in Milwaukee is with us. Hello, Lynn.
Hi. I'm African American, so I'm not... African-American women are not in the desirable group as far as people making comments. They tend to make more derogatory comments. However, I have heard people, mainly, Caucasian people, say things to Asian people to their faces that they would never say to a Hispanic or Black person, because I think Hispanic and Black people, have kind of established a bright line about what they don't want or won't accept said to them. And yet, I hear people say things to Asian people to their face that just is shocking. And then I've also been in conversation with people where they speak very disparagingly, as he said, of Asian men. Oh, nobody wants to date Asian men. Who are they going to date? I mean, it's just really bizarre, the types of things that people will say, both publicly and privately. But what strikes me is what they'll say to Asian Americans just right to their faces.
In radio-friendly terms, Lynn, can you give us an example of something that's said right to their faces?
Well, I think that the young lady's comment I have heard time and time again. Oh, they're subservient. Asian women, you can make them do things. They'll they're not bossy like white women. They're not dominant like Black women. Just crazy things like right to them. When it's as if that person has no individual personality or life story or anything,
Right. Alex?
Yeah, I think that there's truth to what the caller is saying, and it's partly because these stereotypes that we're talking about, that Asian women are sexy and submissive, Asian men are sexless and weak, those are culturally accepted terms. You're not going to get some official to say yes, these are culturally accepted, but they are. They are, in an unspoken way, culturally accepted, and you can see evidence of that every day on entertainment media and in everyday conversations with people. Just as the caller said, people are very open. I had a middle-aged, very politically correct white editor who was very upfront about the fact that he loved Asian women. He loved Asian women. They're sexy.
Yikes.
and this was a guy who was very politically correct in all other ways. And you know what that told me was that it's accepted to say things like that because the rest of the culture accepts it.
You know, it might have just been a People magazine article or something, Alex, but I swear I saw a trend that Asian men were hot. They were sexy. They were, you know, all the stars were dating them. I'm generalizing, but is that another area? Is that the American-born Asians as opposed to the foreign-born Asians?
I might have missed that one. Oh. There was a People magazine article.
Oh, it was a while back. It was like, you know, just some sort of trend. I remember reading it and seeing, I think there were various celebrities hooked up with Asian American men.
Oh. Well, I don't remember that particular article, but I have seen, occasionally I've seen these articles in magazines saying how Asian men are, you know, that their status is changing. And that's generally true. The status of Asian men in general is definitely changing for a whole variety of reasons. Just the fact that you're finding, as one caller said earlier, you're finding all these Asian doctors and dentists and lawyers, you know, the people in power, politicians, athletes, and that's all happening at the same time that the entire continent of Asia is rising economically. And so the profile of the word of people, people that have Asia in their title, Asian American, the profile is rising at the same time that the profile of Asia itself is rising. So, yes, all that affects how people perceive individuals, and individual Asian American men are feeling the benefits of that rise.
Yeah. I mean, we had Jan from Oak Creek who wants to know, did Bruce Lee and Jet Li help change Americans' perceptions of Asian men?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, they did. Yeah, they were among the earliest renditions of Asian men as being capable of power, of being powerful. They went at the same time they did create what is now considered a caricature that you know, of course I grew up and people always asked me if I knew Kung Fu.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because that's the idea that they have in their heads. And of course the Kung Fu master in all of these movies, they're all sexless. Bruce Lee, for example, in all of his American shown movies, never got the girl because it wasn't part of his identity. He was a fighter, not a lover. So a romantic Asian American lead, I believe, is still there have been a few, but I believe he's still pretty absent in the American movie scene.
Yeah. Well, you know, I know that when we're talking about Asian men being sexless, you also talk to some extent in the book about it's not just the Asian physical size in terms of height that that we have a misperception about, or that, that there's this this stereotype that Asian men have small genitalia. Without getting into too many intimate details, how did this resolve for you?
Well, let's see. How do I put it in the book? Like every adolescent in America, you know, I at age 14 or so, I put a ruler to my my member, and my ruler showed me I was definitely average, and yet I did live with this idea that I was supposed to be smaller, and I think that that affected the way I saw myself. The ruler said 6 inches, but maybe the ruler's wrong. Maybe there's something wrong with the ruler. And the idea was that I had internalized the notion that I was supposed to be a small man with a small penis.
And you weren't.
No, I wasn't. I was right in the middle of average, you know, nothing to brag about, mm-hmm. but also nothing to be ashamed of either.
Since we are running up to the top of the hour here, running out of time, how does your story end? What image do you have as yourself now as a man?
I have traveled a long way since that very insecure boy of age of 14. We're talking about events that happened 30, 35 years ago. And I've come a long way in terms of finding my own identity, and part of it has to do with finding largeness and success in the work that I've been called to do. So one of the solutions for me has been focusing my attention away from myself onto something outside of myself, larger than myself, and serving that purpose, serving that calling. That's made me more of a man, or feel like more of a man than anything I did in my personal investigation of manhood.
We'll leave it there. We're out of time. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Alex Tizan, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, author of Big Little Man, In Search of My Asian Self. Thanks to Christy Taylor and to Justin Williams for producing and directing this program. Thanks as well to Bill Martins and to Robin Cherry, who also produce and direct this program. And thank you for listening. I hope you're with us tomorrow. It's the 4th of July, but we will be here with the Week in Review. We'll have two guests from opposing political perspectives to talk with you about the week's top political news stories. It's the Week in Review every Friday at this time. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.